Julie Massa and Rhonda Polk.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Mayor, commissioners, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director of the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. SEIU worked diligently on this legislation in the last session, and we are very excited to be here supporting the outcome of that legislation, including the construction excise tax, and we look forward to the proposal on inclusionary zoning. Affordable housing for our members who sit right in that middle income range between the 50% to 80% of MFI is absolutely critical. Those are hospital workers, state workers, janitors, and security officers. As we have seen, there's been a migration of them to the outer edges of the city as the city continues to become more and more unaffordable for those folks. And the transportation infrastructure to get them in and out of the city has not kept up with that unaffordability. We now operate a 24/7 city where those folks come in at 7 p.m., they leave at 3 a.m., and there's no transportation out of the city. Many of them are here for hours sleeping on benches around the city because they can't get out. Casile, Casper, I spent some time with her recently at the Port of, she works at the Port of Portland, and she was homeless for 6 months because her landlord evicted her so that he could increase her rent, and she was unable to pay. So now she lives in a two-bedroom apartment on the edge of the city with six people. We think that the thousands of development, the millions of dollars in development that has come up around the city isn't keeping the jobs that can afford, frankly, the rents that have gone up. So although we're building larger and larger commercial office space, which we obviously support, the janitors and the security officers who clean and secure those buildings aren't making the income to then afford $70,000 in rent. Sandy McDonough from the PBA, I think, summed it up in a quote for the Oregonian, where she said that when the Portland Business Alliance said, middle-income jobs in the Portland are declining, at the same time, housing has become more expensive. Where are the workers going to be? And I think the PBA and SEIU may not agree on the solution here, but we definitely agree on the problem. And so we're hoping that the council can support this proposal and the inclusionary zoning proposal coming in the fall.
Very much.
Felisa, you talk about members being between 50% and 80% of MFI. Would you argue that we should be comfortable allocating at least some of the money to people in the 60% to 80% range, not just 0% to 60%?
I think that I would be comfortable with the 0% to 60%, but I also feel like the buy downs that were discussed earlier on the inclusionary zoning work was a very critical piece of the legislation for us, because what's happening is, if you don't bring enough markets on that lower income range, then higher income folks are also consuming those units, and then you have that 60 to 80 group who is buying the 30 to 50 group who is stretching their incomes to buy into that 60 to 80 range because there's not enough apartments there, and then you have the above. And then you have that 60 to 80 stretching their incomes buying into the 80, and it sort of puts a continuous pressure on the entire market. And so we feel like if you bring any units on, some of that pressure will be lifted in all of those income ranges so that more workers can move back to closer to where they work.
Thank you. Jean, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Ruth Adkins. I'm Policy Director at Oregon Opportunity Network. We're a statewide association of over 150 affordable housing and community development nonprofits, along with public housing authorities and lots of partners and advocates, and we're all working towards equitable, affordable communities across the entire state. So really want to commend this entire council for the bold steps you've already taken to address the housing crisis here in the city of Portland. And we're here to ask you to continue that by supporting this proposed construction excise tax and by committing to dedicating 100% of the funds to affordable housing. In regard to further exemptions, we would ask that you keep with the proposal from the Housing Bureau and limit any further exemptions. This proposal already includes more than the current schools at CET, so we feel that's an appropriate level where it's at. And really, in general, we want to point out that it's long overdue for the parties that are seeing their profits soar due to the increase in development, the historic, unprecedented boom in our city as the crisis continues to worsen, that those folks who can will pay into a new funding source for affordable housing. We know that strong and equitable communities have to begin with a staunch commitment to providing affordable housing opportunities. So we're here today remembering the people who couldn't be here because they're leaving one job and heading out to another one just so they can continue to barely make ends meet. And we know that you are also going to be leading with the new general obligation bond coming to the ballot, so we're super excited to come back and support you in that. So, Commissioner Saltzman, we want to thank you for your fearless leadership in continuing to bring forth innovative policy solutions and much-needed funding to this crisis. Commissioner Fish, we wanted to thank for his continuing commitment to housing and ensuring that the most vulnerable members of the community have a chance. And Rahel, so we want to thank you for your continued leadership. We believe this vote and every vote you take on housing between now and the end of your term in office is going to be the centerpiece of your legacy. You've stepped in the front of this crisis and said that we as a city can and will do better. Thank you all, and we urge a yes vote. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioners and Mayor. My name is Annie Xiao, Chao Ying Xiao, and I work at the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization at Asian Family Center. At ERCO, we currently provide different kinds of housing-related direct services to immigrant and refugee families, individuals, and also the community at large. Some of these housing services include our mobile housing program, where the team works with other agencies to try and house those who are currently homeless. We also have a school-based housing assistance program at Earl Boyles Elementary School. And also, lastly, we have a rental assistance program where we help families pay for their rent and help them achieve stability through different means. And in the last reporting year, we have served 84 families in this program alone, but we know that this demand is much, much higher. Each time our rental assistance hotline opens, within 10 minutes, we receive at least 50 unique messages from different families and individuals in need of rental assistance. We just don't have enough resources to help everyone who needs it, and we simply have to turn them away. And because we're a wraparound service agency, all of our, over our 160-plus staff help connect clients to housing resources as needed, and we have seen a huge need for affordable housing from our staff's interaction with thousands of community members in the immigrant refugee communities. We appreciate the efforts by the city and the county through a Home for Everyone's initiative to house the homeless and adding hundreds of emergency beds in the past month so that people have a safe place to sleep at night. Still, what we continue to see and hear every day is families doubling up and couch surfing because they can't find affordable housing. Families have to move far away to find affordable housing. That causes them to be far away from their established support networks and causes their kids to have to constantly change schools. What they need is a permanent place to call home. And what we need right now is a more permanent solution, a systemic long-term strategy to create more affordable housing through the construction excise tax and dedicating 100% of it to affordable housing so that our vulnerable immigrant and refugee communities can find a place to call home and do not have to be displaced and removed from their communities again and again. So that as Portland becomes a thriving city, our immigrant and refugee communities can thrive together with the city. So thank you for your support in keeping it 100.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks. The next three are Tara Prince, Julie Massa, and Rhonda Polk. And they'll be followed by Brennan Meinke, Brian Park, and Nick Sovey.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Afternoon.
Who would like to go first?
I think I'm going first.
Okay. You're on.
Thank you, Mayor Hales and councilors, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Julie Massa. And for the past 5.5 years, as a developer for Casa of Oregon, I've worked with 9 groups of ambitious, hardworking, determined homeowners with a shared vision, very similar to the Oakleaf residents here today. They sought to purchase the land underneath their homes, and they wanted to own and take control of their collective futures as a nonprofit cooperative. Those cooperative communities thrive in 9 Oregon towns and cities, and I'll name them for you: McMinnville, Redmond, Gold Beach, Leeburg, Clackamas Bend, Boardman, Idlewild Park near Roseburg, and Dexter near Eugene. Notice that Portland's not on that list. I started when only 2 cooperatives existed, so I have personally worked to transform 7 of the 9 communities into successful resident-owned manufactured home communities that own and operate their cooperative business together. I mentioned that Oakleaf residents have a shared vision for their community. As an experienced cooperative developer, I also see a tremendous cadre of leadership skills, courage within the existing group of Oakleaf residents. Although that vision is still forming in the normal stages of community development, they have come so very far from the threat of losing their homes to coming to you today to request $1.5 million. So I think in their shared vision, they see stability, cooperation, affordable space rent, pride in their community and their accomplishments, structural improvements to their home and their community, and the ability to have very local control of what they collectively own. While Oakleaf is unique, these are the same things that the 9 other communities that I've worked with saw in their vision. I'm here to ask you to grant their request for $1.5 million so that they can put their vision into action. Like the other manufactured home communities have done, additionally, I request that the funds come from a source that contains the maximum amount of flexibility and the least amount of restrictions. There are other communities that face the same threat. I want the council to be aware of that, and hopefully this request can also filter out into those communities. Please adopt Commissioner Saltzman's proposal for the CET, and these funds will help spark vision into action for this community. And thank you for your leadership.
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming. Welcome.
So, Commissioner, could you just give us a brief update on what's happening with the Oakleaf, please?
Well, the owner has agreed to entertain an offer from the residents, and CASA is playing a key role in that. And we would propose that, as I said, we would not spend any of the construction excise tax until there's been an approved plan by council, except for the Oakleaf Mobile Home Park. That's one I would recommend we move ahead on as soon as we can.
And do we have to have the construction excise tax, or could we use the funds in the HIF?
We could probably do that too, but one way or another, we'll get it done.
Yay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, City Council. My name is Tara Prince. I am one of the 30 families living at Oakleaf. Since January of this year, we, the residents, have been fighting to keep our homes. That's why I'm here. If City Council approves this new tax, the Oakleaf residents have an opportunity to save their homes. In December of last year, I bought my home in Oakleaf Mobile Park. I'm a single mom. I moved here to Portland to the Oakleaf residence to build a foundation for myself and my boys, which is something I never had. After a month after purchasing my home, we were all told that we were about ready to lose our homes. Most people facing this kind of loss would give up, but we Oakleaf residents have stood up and are not giving up. Oakleaf residents are hardworking families, seniors, vets, and people with disabilities. The threat of losing our homes, along with our daily struggles, would breed chaos. I have seen the exact opposite, though. Our Oakleaf community has formed a bond that I feel is empowering and growing daily. I have seen my neighbors take pride in our park and now have a new confidence. I recently obtained my first management position, and now I feel like I can give my children a better life. Having a stable home means I can succeed. So again, that's why I'm here. We, the Oakleaf residents, are fighting for our homes, and you, City Council, have an opportunity to help us do that. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Rhonda Polk. I am a resident.
Rhonda, just move the mic a little closer to you so we can hear you. Thank you.
My name is Rhonda Polk. I'm a resident at the Oakleaf and a single mother as well. And we're just appreciative that you guys are taking the time to support us in this as much as you have. And we want the opportunity to show the community that we as a community in itself want to be show better than what has been in the past of the oak leaf. We want to make it look like the images that we have. As far as trailer parks go, people have a negative opinion of them in general. We want the opportunity to show the community that we're not that negative. We have a beautiful image of what we want to share with the community. And so we just want to say thank you again for your support in helping us with this.
Thank you. And you have, as a group, done an amazing job of organizing. So the fact that you are at this place with support here at the city and a lot of other folks behind you is really because you've done such a great job of coming together as a community. So no one can fail to be impressed by what you've done. I'm certainly impressed. So we appreciate you as Portlanders. Thank you very much.
Julie, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
30 families? And 30 families, how many children total?
I have
12 kids. And they're all school-age kids?
Yes. An infant.
I
have an infant. I have a
2-year-old. I have 2 teenagers.
But they're mostly school-age kids.
Yes.
And what we know is that kids that have to move a lot, mm-hmm. it's very disruptive to mm-hmm. their education. So a compelling reason to provide some stability is so kids can continue to go to school and have that continuity.
I know how it is because my school was here. I was born here in 55. My school is not there. My elementary school has changed into Nara, or not, and yeah. And my high school is no longer on 42nd in Killingsworth. There's been a lot of changes in my life in 60 years. But the trailer parks are necessary for low-income, usually of single moms and children. I became a senior. And it fits into my budget due to my disabilities, you know, because I get a disability check once a month. It allows me to be just like everyone else. So we need low housing. We really need it here in Portland. Because I can't even say I want to go camping. What's camping? You're insulting someone because they're homeless. You know, it's a sad thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Mayor, just one other point, Mayor. You've pushed the envelope on sustainability during your tenure. And laid out a vision of a green and sustainable Portland. I hope that when this trailer park community is saved and preserved, the city can look at this holistically, perhaps as a test case of how we can bring our whole toolkit to bear to help create a healthier, more sustainable community within a trailer park community.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good work. I bet we haven't seen the last of this group. Thank you very much. Yeah, you're right.
And that's where most of you come, but ain't just the opening. Because I lived in Pernal, I lived in the old trailer park, and I've lived in Oakley.
Yeah, good point. Thank you.
When I started out, my mom was a single mom, a two boys.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Bless you guys. Amen.
I just want to say I was so happy to see all you guys here because all of you are angels in your own rights. I've watched what you guys have been doing in your works here and there. And I see all you on one panel.
Thank
Bless you.
You
guys.
Thank Would you consider coming back on a weekly basis?
Yeah, it doesn't usually get this good. So
we don't hear from enough people like you, so we appreciate that.
Really?
Wow, okay. I'm not sure who wants to follow that, but 3 people get to do that. So.
The next 3 are Brennan Meinke, Brian Park, and Nick Sovey. And they'll be followed by Mr. Lightning, Missy Baxter, and Bev Logan.
Members of the council, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Brennan Meinke. I'm co-chair of the Affordable Housing Research Action Team with the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. MACG is made up of more than 24 labor, faith, nonprofit, and health equity institutions that work together to bring about change in our community. MACG members and leaders, will you please stand? It's not Oakleaf, but we brought some people.
Good turnout.
Our members hail from all across Portland. They're as diverse as our city, but the one thing that we've heard again and again, as you have, cutting across geographic and social boundaries, is that the cost of housing in Portland is too high. You know this as well as anyone. You've declared a state of emergency, and we thank you for the commitment you've shown in taking concrete steps to ease our housing crisis. But despite the gains made in the past year, both locally with the increase in TIF funding, which we thank you for your support on, and at the state level with the loosening of the inclusionary zoning restrictions, the housing situation here in Portland continues to worsen. The water is still rising, the gap is still widening, and that state of emergency continues. There are other needs in Portland beyond housing, and we recognize that. But in a crisis, one must address the most critical needs first. In Portland, that need is clear, and so we strongly support Commissioner Saltzman's proposal to allocate 100% of the construction excise tax money to housing. The money generated by the CET can't make up the difference, as you've noted, but it can help fill in gaps in our affordable housing infrastructure. Many Portlanders cannot afford the workforce housing that inclusionary zoning is designed to provide, and most Portlanders do not live in an urban renewal area eligible for TIF funding. We must provide housing opportunities for all Portlanders, and especially those most vulnerable between 0 and 60%. The CE tax, the construction excise tax, will help with that, and we must continue to explore the innovative approaches like we've seen with the Oakleaf community here. So thank you for all the work you've been doing, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you. Welcome.
Members of the council, thank you so much for having us today. My name is Brian Park. I'm a family medicine and preventive medicine resident at the Oregon Health and Science University. Sorry to hear that you all are sick. I'd offer you my services, but I think that could be construed as a conflict of interest, possibly. But I work and train at OHSU Richmond Clinic, which is a community health center that serves as a safety net clinic for the Southeast Portland neighborhood. And we treat all patients regardless of their insurance, income, and background. And that really is a fabric of our identity, both in the clinic and certainly a fabric of my identity as a provider as well. I really love what I do. The relationships that I get to form with my patients over the weeks and months and now years, and the privilege to work with them through some of the most troubling parts of their lives. As I progress in my residency training, however, I am struck repeatedly by how healthcare does not occur solely within the walls of the clinic or at the exam room, but largely outside the clinic walls. And I thought this just last week when I saw a patient of mine. His name is David over at Richmond. I met David during my first month of residency 2 years ago now. And in that time, David has been to the emergency room 14 times for a bad skin infection in his foot that he is predisposed to because of his diabetes. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to reveal to you that it wasn't until after his fourth emergency department visit that I thought to ask him point blank what you're all likely wondering already, which is, David, why all these infections? Brian, he said, you keep asking me to take my insulin and keep my leg elevated. Now, how am I supposed to do that when I have, how am I supposed to keep my insulin refrigerated and keep my leg up when I'm sleeping out on the streets? David is really special, dear, and unique to me, but in a way, I also have many patients like David, whose life circumstances preclude them from living happy and healthy lives. And these circumstances are so entangled with what we do in medicine, we call them the social determinants of health, that a colleague at the Richmond Clinic and I started an initiative to organize patients and community partners to better identify and address these social determinants. In organizing meetings with over 60 patients just this past year, we quickly found that the most prevalent and significant influence in the health and lives of our patients is lack of secure and affordable housing. This overwhelming need for stable housing in our community resonated with us, so much so that we went and asked our Department of Family Medicine over at OHSU to join MACG as a member institution, and so that we residents could better understand the social determinants that affect our patients here in Portland. And I'm glad to say that the department quickly agreed to that. So I understand the irony of me as a medical provider sitting in front of you today, asking individuals outside the healthcare sector to keep our patients healthy. But I hope you'll also see that your policy decisions directly impact the social determinants of health for many Portlanders. And I want to empower you with that truth. You shape policies that can forge and uphold a just society. And in a truly just society, we can all pursue health, wellness, and happiness. So here I sit in front of you, asking you to help us help David, help Portland by maximizing the funds for affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Nick, welcome.
Mayor Hales and City Council, thank you for what you've done and what you will do to promote affordable housing here in Portland. I'm Nick Sovey. I'm the Director of Rose Community Development, and I'm the co-chair of the East Portland Action Plan Housing Subcommittee. At our EPAP Housing Subcommittee meeting this week, we voted to support 100% of the construction excise tax going to affordable housing, and I hope you'll pass that today. Resources for affordable housing are an important part of East Portland's anti-displacement strategy. Rose is doing a project called Baby Booster now to support pregnant women and families with young children because that helps them in their lifelong health. And when we talk to parents in the neighborhood, what they tell us is we need more affordable housing. That's what we can do to promote healthy babies. If you need another reason to vote for this, I'm just reading a book called Evicted, and it's just a horror story of what happens when we don't have affordable housing in our city. So I hope you'll vote today to adopt the construction excise tax and devote 100% of that to affordable housing. Thanks very much.
So, Nick, do you have any comments about the whether multifamily should be commercial or residential?
I mean, it's your call. I understand the argument that we could keep the money here in Portland, and you know, I think that's a really compelling argument.
Thank you,
Nick. Just two other points. We'd never like to disappoint you, but today's a first reading, so it's going to go over to a second reading. So we're not withholding the vote. But,
Rome wasn't built in the day,
and just. I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but there has been a tremendous amount of effective lobbying advocacy work on this, and my sense is that there's now strong support up here for the 100% dedication. So I know that's you want to reinforce that and make sure that we don't backtrack from that, but my sense is that that has now enjoys strong support on this side. And thank you for all your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
The next three are Lightning Watchdog PDX, Missy Baxter, and Bev Logan. And they'll be followed by the last three who signed up, Sarah Farmer, Marion Haynes, and Emerald Bogue.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Lightning with Lightning Watchdog PDX. I was a little hesitant on this at the beginning, but after listening to Mr. Dame and also knowing Homer Williams would be at agreement on this, I definitely give it a yes and support this. A couple disagreements I have with Mr. Dame is I would like to also see the brownfield exemption put into place. We do need to offer more incentives on these type of more challenging properties. And again, why I was hesitant on this at the beginning is I prefer to have more incentives to the developers. I'm always hesitant on anything mandatory, exclusionary zoning. But again, I've changed my mind. If Mr. Dame agrees with that and the developers don't have an issue, then why not? Absolutely. Now, another commitment I hope that Mr. Dame and Homer Williams will stand by is their proposal on the $100 million homeless campus. I hope that the city will also understand that they need to step forward on that Northwest Front Avenue property. Be reasonable. Don't sell it to them like your PDC director wanted to buy that property out of Troutdale. Be reasonable on your assessment of values and use the public taxpayers' dollars reasonably. Do not take advantage of them. And the only other issue, again, like I say, is that, Mr. Salzman, don't get too aggressive on that obligation bond. Stay around $100 million. Do not get overly aggressive. Commissioner Novick understood what happens when you do that. Thank you.
Lightning, can I just point out that as the commissioner in charge of the bureau that owns that currently owns what we call T1, Terminal 1 North.
Yes.
I want to be clear, and I'm issuing a memo tomorrow that will be a public record, and it'll state more clearly. I fully support the vision that Homer Williams has put out there. joining with a lot of other people in the community who applauded him for his private sector leadership and willingness to bring private dollars to support this effort, because this would be a sea change in terms of the amount of private investment. And I'm going to lay out in a memo what are the legal and practical obstacles to using T1, and I'll let, for the purpose of letting people like you and others make your own judgment, and I want it to be as transparent as possible. If there's a path, I'd like to know what it is. I think when you see the full array of challenges at that site, including the zoning and the comp plan and the ownership and the and some other legal issues, it will give you a full picture to which to make your own judgment as to whether that's the appropriate location.
And if I might just add real fast, Mr. Dame and Mr. Williams have the potential to do deals that very few people could ever do in this city. So I have the utmost confidence in them putting this deal together if that's the direction they want to go. And I hope City Hall will work with them and understand this is important to see this happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, council members, for your support and the chance to speak today. My name is Beverly Logan, and I'm a leader with Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. MACG leaders and others have testified about our position on the issues before you today and some of the reasons why we believe 100% of the commercial construction excise tax should be devoted to affordable housing. I want to speak more directly, though, to why the construction excise rates should be established at no less than 1%, more if possible, for both residential and commercial construction, lest anyone suggest a lesser rate. And it sounds like industry folks have already offered some resistance to that idea. For 17 years, a ban on inclusionary zoning prevented construction of affordable housing on any meaningful scale in any city in our state. That ban has a large share of responsibility for the housing crisis that we stagger under today. It was put in place in the interests of industry lobbies at the expense of our communities. This year, our legislature considered a bill to finally lift the ban on IZ. MACG testified in support of that bill, as did the City of Portland and every other jurisdiction in Oregon who testified, along with a broad spectrum of other community nonprofits, all of whom feel the crushing effects of the housing crisis on the people and communities we serve. It's important here to recognize that some developers, we heard from one, responsible developers also went out of their way to testify in support of lifting that ban in its the bill in its original form. So we were distressed to see a decent bill loaded up with amendments, weakened and constrained from accomplishing the good that was intended originally. The final legislation seemed, according to testimony in those hearings and questioning from Senate Finance Committee members, the bill seemed to have, in its final form, seemed to have been shaped largely, again, in the interests of industry lobbies, in strong-arm deals without the presence of virtually any community voice. Groups like ours were forced to hold our noses and urge passage of the legislation anyway, in favor of getting the chance for a little more affordable housing rather than no improvement at all. The bright spot, though, in the IZ compromises was the ability to institute a construction excise tax and have some way to pay for affordable units for people earning below 80% of median family income, for which the final IZ legislation made no provision at all. We urge you to ensure that here in Portland, no powerful industry interests will bring the CET rates to any level below 1%. The home builders and realtors lobbies already had their way with the state legislation, hampering our ability to begin closing the gap of dire need for more affordable housing. We hope you'll draw a line for Portlanders and provide courage to other communities by establishing both residential and commercial CET rates at the maximum possible and with no additional exemptions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Keep it 100.
Thank you. Others?
The last three who signed up are Sarah Farmer, Marion Haynes, and Emerald Bogue.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, council members. My name is Marion Haynes, and I am with the Portland Business Alliance. We represent nearly 1,900 businesses in the region. We couldn't agree more that housing affordability is an absolutely critical issue facing the city right now. It's a challenge, as you heard, not only for individuals and families, but it is a growing challenge for businesses as well, who need to attract and retain a qualified workforce, for whom having to live so far from where you work can make things really difficult. So couldn't agree more that this is something that we need to address. We did work on and support the inclusionary zoning bill, which the construction excise tax is a part of. Our main effort there was to ensure that there are incentives that relate to the requirement for inclusionary zoning. Wasn't so much to achieve absolute proportionality, but we know that if the balance is not struck correctly, that it could limit the amount of development that would actually go forward. It's math, really, and it's as simple as math. So it doesn't all have to be financial incentives. That was one of the pieces in the bill, and that question came up earlier. There's different kinds of incentives that can be brought to bear, but those pieces are important to making those developments pencil and move forward so that we don't inadvertently exacerbate our situation, because a lot of what we have, as we heard, is a supply problem. So we do not object to the construction excise tax per se. We would prefer that we looked at it a little bit more closely and took the time to do so in conjunction with some of the other things that are being developed and proposed, like the inclusionary zoning program, like transportation demand management fees, and all of these things are interrelated and come into play when you're doing that math equation looking at your development. So that is our preference. There are, when you look at some of these things together, if the inclusionary doesn't have the appropriate incentives, without an incentive, you could see rents go up 15% and more people forced into needing an affordable home that needs support rather than just being able to afford the market rate on their own. So that is our preference. We do also would be very interested in the brownfield discussion that you are having. I think converting those lands back into productive use, often industrial use, and things that do contribute to family wage jobs so that people can afford a home. Thanks.
Karen, can I just follow up with one question? No, I understand the reservations you've identified. Do you, though, support the focus of Dan's legislation that says the money should be targeted at 60% and below? Putting aside the question of whether you think it'll have a unintended consequence in terms of exacerbating some market conditions, do you support the focus of taking the revenue and applying it to where the greatest need is at 60 and below?
I think that's the answer is a little bit complicated, I would say. I think that part of our preference in looking at this more broadly with the inclusionary zoning is whether the 50% of the residential component of the construction excise tax is sufficient in order to make the inclusionary program successful. So I think that's one piece that needs to be looked at. Generally, I recognize that there is a large need there. We've always been concerned about the middle income portion that there is a need for as well. And so it's something that we haven't had the time or the ability or the data to really look at in a comprehensive way. And that's really our point, that we don't object to this. We'd like to spend a little bit more time structuring it and understanding how all the different components fit together.
You know, appreciate you raising the question of context. I did, in my due diligence and thinking about this proposal, I was looking at a Group McKinsey report on total development costs. You know, we're in a good place with or without this additional cost, given the data that they found. For example, an $11 million warehouse project in Hillsborough would pay $1 million in fees, in Tualatin $1 million. And Wilsonville, again, over $1 million, $800,000 in Woodburn, and $573,000 in Portland. So we have an enormous cost advantage, $2.80 a square foot versus $5.25. against the suburbs for that project. Similar numbers for a multi-tenant mixed-use project where we're at $11.52 a square foot versus $18 in Beaverton and $19 in Sherwood. So the total cost of development in the city, really reflecting the fact that we're more compact and we don't have to build miles of roads out into fields, is now really starting to manifest itself, which is maybe one of the reasons why our vacancy rates are so low. So I think it's certainly an environment in which we can bear this cost and still be market competitive. But I think it's good that you raised the context question.
Mayor, I got an email the other day from a gentleman who was very critical of the fact that we had sent him a notice of his opportunity to get a water quality report from the Water Bureau. And in his notice back, he said he was outraged that we would waste taxpayer money sending it to him because he no longer lives in Portland. And in order to escape the outrageously high water rates, he had moved to Lake Oswego.
Oops.
And so I sent him a very polite response, and I said, thank you for bringing to our attention that we may have sent the notice to the wrong address, although we actually do have people in Lake Oswego who are part of our service district. But I didn't want to argue the point. And I said in my response, I'm sure there are many good reasons to live in Lake Oswego, but I regret to inform you that you're paying more for your water in Lake Oswego than you are in Portland.
Yep. Thanks, Marion.
Actually, I did have one question. Marion, in Sandy McDonough's letter to Commissioner Saltzman, it says that the Alliance urges that an overall dollar cap be added to the non-residential CET. And what that would mean potentially is that whereas we'd have a 1% tax for most non-residential developments, if it's a really humongous development, then it might be a 0.5% tax. And I just wanted to ask you, if you were us, how would you justify giving special treatment to humongousness?
Commissioner Novick, every other construction excise tax that has been enacted in this area, the Portland Public Schools construction excise tax and the Metro construction excise tax, has adopted a dollar cap on the non-residential component. And I think that is an acknowledgement that we continue to want to create jobs and that some of the commercial developments that do that and bring good, high-paying jobs into the area are substantial amounts of money for those developments, far more than you would see in any typical residential or mixed-use kind of environment. So I wouldn't suggest that cap is tapped at the same place where they did for the schools or for the Metro construction tax, but I think that was the acknowledgement of both of them, and we think that there's some value to exploring that and being able to, if we had the full context and knew some of the costs of the developments that and the potential that were coming here, we could better understand that and discuss it.
But is the argument that the biggest projects are more effective in terms of job creation? So like on a dollar-per-dollar basis? For example?
Not necessarily. And I think what we suggested in the letter is that this should be explored. And it sort of goes to the other pieces of my testimony that I think all of these things need to be looked at in totality. And I appreciate what Mayor Hale said. I've seen that report from Group McKenzie myself. I think there's other costs and fees associated with the city of Portland that drive up the cost. I think there's other benefits and amenities to developing and locating in the city of Portland that make it beneficial for people to want to do that. I think ultimately when you're looking at these issues, they're very complicated. The property tax bond, the inclusionary zoning, the construction excise tax, demand management fees, changes to FAR bonus systems, changes in heights and different things like that that were contained in the comprehensive plan are complicated, and they come together when somebody's looking at a potential development. And wanting to just fully understand that was really our objective in our comments, not that we have any fundamental opposition to a support for affordable housing, which we agree is a tremendous need in the city.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Emerald Bogue, and I'm with the Port of Portland. I think all of you received a letter from our Deputy Director applauding your leadership on the topic and asking for a couple of considerations. I'm not going to spend time going through that today. I just want to call out specifically appreciation for the desire to take a deeper look at brownfields and call out a little bit of confusion that I felt was illustrated earlier around industrial land and brownfields. And coming out of the comp plan process, I can understand the gray area there. Certainly the city's looking to brownfields as a big part of the industrial land supply. But for the sake of a consideration as an exemption here, these are pretty different things. Brownfields right now are polluted pieces of property that are doing nothing for your tax rolls, nothing at all. And just from the 30,000-foot level, there's a couple different types of brownfield. There's a brownfield where the cost of a cleanup greatly exceeds the market value, or maybe you're at a break-even point. And then there's a brownfield where, you know, the market value might be more than the cost of a cleanup. And in that case, the private market tends to pick it up. But where government has to work really hard is in the first example, where we have to really look hard at incentives toward developing these properties. And these properties are not, they don't tend to be prime real estate, right? They tend to be in neighborhoods that need it the most. So I really encourage you to take a closer look at this. And we're happy to offer some of our technical experts who have a lot of experience in this.
Emerald, I heard Dyke essentially say there's good brownfields and bad brownfields,
yeah.
I mean, to really overly generalize. And to be clear, and I don't know what Commissioner Fritz is planning, but I'd like to get all of our heads together. What I'm interested in is on the good brownfields, where there is a compelling public interest in providing an array of subsidies to jumpstart the development so that a brownfield that's in representative, now State Senator Lou Frederick's district, that has been an environmental justice issue for too long and could be converted to productive use, creating economic opportunity, that we not inadvertently put another barrier in the way of accomplishing that goal. Now, we've set big goals in our comp plan about brownfields. So that's mine. So I'm interested in the good brownfields and the ones in which the barrier to moving on this has been the inability to come up with a package of incentives in Salem that get buy-in. And one of the objections, of course, is some of our environmental friends believe that polluters should pay, and they object to the idea of a subsidy. But if we're now on essentially on the clock to get these brownfields into productive use to comply with the comp plan, I want to make sure that on the good brownfields, this doesn't become another obstacle.
Yes, and we share that interest. And, you know, the legislature has granted us a couple tools that we can use, tax abatement and land banking. And I think that there's a coalition working on how do you apply these things? How does that work? And there's certainly no shortage of brownfields. One particular challenge that the city will need to look at in this scenario is defining a brownfield appropriately to make sure that, you know, not anyone could just say, hey, I'm a brownfield. You know, I'm exempt.
That's why
you want to look really carefully at a definition. And our attorney, who works on this really closely in-house, crafted some language that he thinks gets you there. Because what you don't want to do, you want to reward the people who are doing something with brownfields, who are cleaning them up, right? So we want to incent action here.
Well, that's why I'm also, I would be open to the idea that we set some criteria and provide an opportunity for someone to seek an exemption if they meet the criteria, rather than trying to get into the morass of defining every possible contingency.
That's great. We'd be happy to help.
Yeah, if you could send us your proposed language, that'd be really helpful.
Of course. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both. Anyone else? If not, then
Director Krieger back for a second.
Get some questions for staff, and then we'll bring this hearing to a close. This comes back for a vote next week.
Is it next week or the week after?
I think it's next week, right?
Is it next week?
You can come back next week or
yeah, whatever your preference is. Come on up, Kurt.
How may I help?
Well, first, you've helped by providing a really clear framework for our consideration and outstanding testimony, so thank you for that. And what I just want to better understand is, if there was interest in exploring, let's say, some kind of discretionary exemption for brownfields, what's the timeline for us to bring that forward? Does it have to be done by next week when this comes up for a second reading? Can that be carved out for further consideration and brought back later? What advice do you have for us?
Well, that's probably a city attorney question, frankly, but this is scheduled to go into effect on August 1st. So transactions at the BDS counter would start to take effect on August 1st. If someone were to vest a, well, if someone were to apply for a construction permit, not a grading permit, because we parsed out grading permits and demolition permits, but if someone were vesting and applying for an actual construction permit, this would apply beginning August 1st. If they were applying for a grading permit or a demolition permit, it wouldn't apply. So it really depends on where they are in that process. The exemption would have to be in place, I think, upon enactment for it to apply, unless you were in some way able to consider a rebate or something like that.
So we have to figure that out.
Why did you pick August 1st rather than July 1st?
Well, I think there was Matthew is approaching us.
It was a timing issue with all of the changes that are happening to the track system in advance of the SDC increases. BDS needed additional time, roughly 4 to 5 weeks, to make the adjustments to the system. And from a transactional standpoint, the preference of BDS is that new fees, taxes, or increases occur on the first of the month.
Right. No, that makes sense. Thank you.
This is like a sick ward looking down here with all this Kleenex. Can I make a suggestion? Perhaps in the next couple days, Kurt, you and Dan can determine whether there is a strong enough sense of the council to explore this issue. Obviously, there'd have to be at least three motivated people. And then what are the options for either seeking to get some language now or a placeholder? And then thinking it through. My guess is there aren't a lot of people in the queue right now who are going to be doing brownfield work as of August 1st. I mean, the last project BES did took 10 years, and these things are few and far between, and there's enormous obstacles. But if we could get a sense of whether there's an appetite for such an exemption, and then what our options are. And the other thing I just want to preview is that while I really appreciate that at the appropriate time, the Bureau is going to come forward with a menu of options for how to spend the new money. I hope that in the preparation of a recommendation to Council, we go back to the very stark number you gave us earlier, that of the 24,000 units that were short that you've identified, that's not including the additional 10,000 over the life of the comp plan and the growing number annually that were short. I hope we take into account that 17,530 of those, or more than three quarters, are for households that are really struggling at the very low end. And so I'll be looking for if not a strict proportional allocation, a substantial investment in meeting those needs. And I understand that the challenge you face is that housing to serve people who are very poor requires subsidies through services in addition to the additional costs of developing. And I know there's a trade-off in terms of units built and the cost structure, but because the need is so graphic, I want to make sure that these new dollars, which you and Dan should be congratulated for leading us to this point and achieving new funds, goes to where the greatest need is.
I pulled the chart of incomes, and for those people that don't live with this data on a regular basis, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, a couple of 30% of median income has got an income of $17,600, a family of four, $22,000. So these folks have income. In fact, a single person at 30% of AMI would have $15,400.
That's a full-time minimum wage worker.
Indeed, it is. And if you're on Social Security, you're going to be more like 13% of the area median. So when we talk about this classification, it encompasses a lot of real people who are struggling, obviously, not just to pay rent, but to cover other daily expenses. So we are mindful of that, and we'll take that into consideration.
Okay. And next week still makes sense for you?
Yeah.
Sorry? Go ahead.
I want to come back to this issue of classifying multifamily as residential or commercial, because the $778,000 on the line that I would prefer to keep in Portland rather than to go back to the state, unless that's specific. I'd like to be able to have the opportunity to talk with Speaker Kotek and the sponsors of the resolution. My understanding is the industry standard is that multifamily is commercial, and that gives us not only $778,000 a year more to spend in Portland, it's more flexible than the dollars in the residential bucket. So I don't know why we would not want to do that.
Well, I guess, I mean, that's a legitimate point of view to pursue, and, you know, we can seek more clarity from the legislative leaders. But I guess I also just want to hearken back to the legislative debate and remind us that at any time, Portland could have bailed out of this statewide solution, and we could have gotten a Portland-only solution. And I resisted that because I feel that this crisis is truly a statewide solution. And so I don't, you know, I feel there's some, I don't feel bad about 15% of the 1% of the residential going to statewide affordability, because it truly is, you know, we're all in this together. So that's just my own perspective on it.
Yeah, and 40% of our taxes already go outside of Portland and don't come back. So I'd just like to the opportunity to come back next week if it, after having had some conversations to see, you know, and if other jurisdictions are making their multifamily commercial rather than residential, then probably we should do what everybody else is doing.
I think they're all waiting for us.
All right.
Yeah, I would also mention that the schools are the schools that levy a construction excise tax do it by use. So that precedent has already been established.
And the permit is by permit category, but the occupancy is how the schools levy their tax, by occupancy type, residential versus commercial.
A question I'd like to ask the city attorney is, does it matter to the interpretation of state law what characterization we put on it? It seems to me that state law is what state law is, and whatever we call multifamily housing here shouldn't have an effect on what that is. I mean, so what I would guess is that we can call it whatever we want, and then we can ask for a clarification of legally what we're required to do. And right. Do we have to pay that 15%? Or we might decide we choose to send the state 15%, if that makes sense, I guess. But I wonder whether it really makes a difference what we call it.
Well, let's research that question.
There's a lot of money on the line.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to return to those questions as well next week and bring this back for a second reading and potential amendment next week.
Okay.
All right. Thank you all very much. We conclude this item, and we're adjourned until next week. Good job, Dan.